This podcast is supported by VEPLA, Victorian Planning Environmental Law Association. Welcome to the Planning Exchange, where we interview built environment professionals who are doing interesting work beyond the ordinary. I'm Jess Noonan, and I'm joined by my colleague, Peter Jewell.
Today, we're speaking with Anna Lauder. Anna is a co-founder and director of Hampstead, a new urbanist community located in Montgomery, Alabama. Hampstead is a 416-acre master-planned residential and mixed-use development located in Montgomery, Alabama. Homes range from $330 to $1 million. Established in 2008, the vibrant new urbanist community is built on walkable, living and sustainable design, combining single-family homes, townhomes and flats with restaurants, shops, workspaces, school and wellness. Hampstead is the first new community in the US to be designed and built under the Smart Code, an innovative zoning code that encourages diverse, mixed-use neighbourhoods for all ages and stages of life. The result is a community built on living, working, preserving and growing over time in a multi-generational mixed-use community where people of all ages, interests and socioeconomic segments can interact as neighbours, local business owners, visitors and students. Welcome to the show, Anna. Thank you for coming to us all the way from the US this morning. Oh, sorry, this evening for you.
Can you give our listeners a brief background on how you got to where you are growing up? I understand that you come from your family background is that your family had a building company, and a bit about your education.
Sure. So I was born and grew up here in Montgomery, Alabama, in the South. And I finished high school and I went to college at Boston University. And while I was there, I went to their study abroad program in London. And that was really my first introduction, obviously, to living in Europe, but also, you know, being in a walkable, exciting, you know, super vibrant in a metropolitan environment. And I just loved London. I love the scale of it. I love that it's very different from New York. You know, many areas, especially the ones that were not touched by World War II, or, you know, four to five stories max height, a real sense of neighborhoods and personalities there. And it was during that time there, and then afterwards, when I finished university and moved to London for a period of time, I discovered the new urbanist movement, which has its roots in essentially, you know, timeless town planning, village planning, like you see all throughout Europe. And you also still see that in many places in the United States, like Savannah, Charleston, older cities like that. But we had lost that here in the US. So I spent time studying what the new urbanist theory is, which is really just mixed use, community building, an approachable scale where all of your daily needs are met in a single place. And so, as you said, since my family's background was building, we've been in real estate development and construction since the 1950s. I thought, well, you know, why don't we put some of those ideas to use and test them out and see what the uptake is back in the United States. So I moved back from London to Montgomery in 2005 and started doing that.
And can you just provide our listeners a bit of background around where Montgomery is located, its size, its weather, and so forth?
Sure. So, I mean, we're very centrally in the heart of the American South. So, as many of your listeners might know, Montgomery is both the birthplace of the American Civil War and the American Civil Rights Movement. So we do have a lot of history here. It's a capital city. It's the capital of Alabama. So you get a lot of government and lawyers and military programs and things like that. It is very warm here. Some would say hot, humid. So, you know, we essentially have spring, a very long summer, a fall, and almost no winter. It's a lovely place. It's very ecologically diverse. We have mountains, you know, farms and prairies and forests and beaches and everything. So get a wide range, and it's very centrally located near Atlanta, Nashville, New Orleans, Charleston, and then the Gulf Coast.
And the population?
It's around 250,000 for the metropolitan area of Montgomery.
Okay.
Anna, can you talk a bit about your first development projects and how those broke the mold a little bit?
Yes. So My dad always says, you know, the pioneers because the arrows that are in their backs. When I moved back here from London and thought, okay, well, let's try some of these things out. You know, smaller scale developments were obviously the easiest option. And at that time, the Montgomery downtown area essentially had no residential at all. You know, during the 1960s and 70s, people sort of fled the city center, building stock still intact. And so we took one of those buildings. It was a former warehouse, and we developed that into lofts with commercial space on the ground floor, you know, very typical. And from there, we did an urban infill project that was all new construction. And at that time, it was the first mixed-use new construction project in Montgomery in 50 years. So that one was an old A&P grocery store site. And so we call it the Atlantic and Pacific Lofts. And it had a combination of lofts, and everything on the ground floor is commercial with restaurants and offices and shops. And then we built, adjacent to that, we built new construction cottages, which really beautifully fit in with the historic architecture of that neighborhood. And after that, we got into larger scale development, like what we're doing here at Hampstead.
Thanks for the support from Ratio Consultants, an independent voice and trusted partner in planning, urban design, transport, and waste management. Ratio supports change through projects that shape cities, neighborhoods, and places for people. See ratio.com.au for details.
One of the most difficult things about innovation and doing something different in the development space is quite often planning and getting city planners on board, which I'm assuming it's the same in America, but in Australia, you know, it does take time quite often for rules to kind of adjust to new development types and new innovation. Is that the same in the US, and what kind of challenges did you face with the city planners?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a great question. So when we began Hampstead, you know, it's a 416 acre project. So we took the approach that many new urbanist communities do. We had hired a DPC and company, Duane Potter Zyberg. And in my opinion, they were the most experienced new town planners in the United States. And so the key thing there was to use their experience and their expertise and follow any advice they had to give. And the way they like to structure these master plans, we did a week-long process, an open charrette process. And we invited every single elected official, municipal utility departments, the fire department, all of it, to all of the meetings, and talked about the concepts and what we were proposing as far as a master plan. And also all of it was open to the public. We would do presentations in the evenings of how the work had progressed. And then at the end of it all, a final presentation. But what we did in doing that, you know, we built trust amongst the city officials, and we said, okay, this could be a great project for you. Obviously, you know, a lot of money and time and thought and years will go into it. And we have the expertise of these amazing planners and architects. But in order for this project to come to fruition, we're asking you to change the zoning laws here. And so there was conversations and, you know, some exchanges. In order for this to be in Montgomery, this has to happen. And, you know, a lot of that does always come down to relationships and having long-term friendships and partnerships with people, and trusting that, you know, everyone's out to do what I would say is the right thing. And so during that process of the design week, we took the smart code, which is here in the US, it's one that has been developed by new urbanists to be able to be calibrated to any municipality. And we had worked and calibrated it for Montgomery, you know, street widths and tree types and all of that. And we got the city council to pass it and approve it unanimously as an option to be used throughout the city of Montgomery. And so, you know, I think, again, it's just building trust and using relationships and saying, we want to do something better. Here's why, here's what it could be. And then not backing down from that.
And I also apart from government, there's the marketing and the public acceptance of the project. You mentioned the AMP development. How to get the public on site?
Well, again, you know, that requires a lot of communication and conversations and meetings. And given that that specific project was in an older historic part of town, you know, you do get people concerned if you're doing new construction or new development of any kind that it will take away the character of the existing neighborhood. So, you know, part of that is hiring the right people. Again, you know, when we have a project, I always look for people that are far smarter than me and far more talented, because those are the people I want in my corner. And so hiring excellent architects who just happen to be local as well. I mean, they're nationally renowned architects, but everyone here in the community trusts them because they're friends and neighbors. That goes a long way. And, you know, meeting with the historical commissions and meeting with the neighbors and saying, this will be an attribute. I'm taking an eyesore, which is an empty parking lot and a derelict building, and we are offering to do this. And so just clearly communicating your vision and your intent goes a long way. And that is one thing about, before I got into real estate development fully, you know, my background was in communications and journalism. So I can talk to anyone about anything and honestly say, this is why we're doing this, this is how we're going to do it, and this is what the outcome will be.
And regardless of that, Anna, did you still face some backlash from the community about the proposal, or did that sort of turn around once people saw development commencing?
It did turn around, and some of that took a little bit of time. You know, once you start showing people, you know, how we're going to build it, we're going to maintain your character, and we're going to add to this, and they could see it. I think that's a major thing, is not just talking and showing pretty pictures, but once they see the products going up with quality material and the craftsmanship is good, people naturally will start to see it in a positive light if it's as you have described it.
People are always quite dubious of renders, don't you find?
Yes. So there's a lot, there's a saying here, it's called NIMBYism. I don't know if you have that in Australia. I mean, not in my backyard. So it's always like, oh, that's something new, that's something foreign, I'm not really comfortable with it. I can't exactly say why, but I don't think that's different.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can apply that to many things in life, but you know, it's just convincing people to have a different mindset by showing them. And I think there's no other way. I mean, people will always complain about something. Otherwise, what would they have to do with their life? Absolutely. But showing them that there are different and possibly better ways, I think, is really the only opportunity you have as a developer to try something new.
Yeah. And so it's a multi-stage development, approximately 25 years. And how many stages?
So the way that our master plan is designed is three distinct neighborhood centers or cores. And each one, you know, has commercial, which could be offices, restaurants, you know, civic sites like schools or churches or, you know, gathering halls, and health and wellness within it. And so we essentially have completed our first neighborhood town center at this point. And we have all of those things I just described. Plus, obviously, we've got, I think, about 250 single family homes, and then another, say, 90 flats, which are leased or rental spaces. So we have like a 3-to-1 ratio between homes and rentals. And we do that, you know, to provide different price points and different options for people as far as size and, you know, where they are in their life. And so at this point, you know, we could easily have another 15 years to go, and that's fine. And like I said, based on our zoning, we're able to scale up or scale down depending on what market demands or what we would like to do with future phases.
And I'm curious as well around this term walkability. Obviously, walkability means something different to probably everyone in terms of how far they can walk comfortably. When we say that this is a walkable community, what do we mean by that? Are we talking about, you know, shops and services all being within 400 metres of housing, or is it a certain percentage of housing being within 400 metres, or what's the definition in your books?
So, well, from my perspective, walkability means that you can have the majority of your daily needs met by leaving your front door and being able to walk there. Now, some people don't want to walk more than a block or two. Some people want to walk all day long, right? So there's different perspectives on this. But you know, for instance, here, someone could wake up, a parent could wake up and walk their children to our Montessori school, drop them off, walk to the farm, you know, tend to their vegetables, whatever, go to different shops and pick up, you know, something from the home store, go to a workout class at the neighborhood gym or yoga, the yoga studio, drop by or walk to work if they like. And then of course, you know, after work, you've got places where you can meet up with your friends or your family and have a drink or have a meal. And, you know, within that, that's a large part of what a large day is. I mean, of course, granted, we're never going to be able to compete with large, what we would call lifestyle centers that have big box retail. You know, we're not going to have a Target here. We're not going to have a Home Depot or something like that. But all of that is within, you know, a 2-mile drive of Hampstead. So for us, it's a reduction in the use of the car on a daily basis. And the benefit is healthfulness and just a sense of community you build by being outside and connecting with your neighbors daily.
We thank Victorian Planning Reports, our very first supporter. If you want the A to Z of planning decisions in Victoria and excellent editorials, please get yourself a subscription to the VPRs. Details on our website.
This podcast is supported by our wonderful friends at One Mile Grid. One Mile Grid is a boutique consulting firm which offers traffic and transport engineering, transport planning and waste management services. You can find out more by visiting their website at www.onemilegrid.com.au.
Anna, I've heard you talk previously about relativity of the walking. If the walk is, will determine how much people walk. Can you just talk to that, please?
Sure. So a major part of our design in every phase is that we make the opportunity to get out of the house and have a healthier lifestyle possible. And by that, I mean, every street, you know, has obviously slow speed limits and is narrower than, say, typical suburban cul-de-sacs or developments, but there's also sidewalks on every street, both sides of the street, and we have to have street trees, which sounds strange to some people. It's like, what does that mean? Well, that provides shade and it provides, you know, a beautiful walking environment. And then on top of that, you know, walking for the sake of walking is fine, but it can be boring. So the reason that people continue to walk is because there are interesting things to look at. So that's where, you know, the architectural details come in and the way that the blocks are sized and the way that the houses are situated. So, you know, throughout the year, the neighborhood can feel very differently, but you're always entertained with, you know, what someone has done in their front yard or how this house looks or how, you know, this is decorated for this holiday. And then ultimately you can arrive at a larger destination. So that could be, you know, a formal civic space in the town center. That could be, you know, a bocce pavilion where you can, you know, play a game outside, or it could be, you know, whatever you're going to in the town center to do and then walk back. So it's in a sense, keeping a resident, keeping people or a visitor, keeping them entertained, which sounds strange to say, but keeping their mind looking at things and noticing things so that it's not just a mundane walk. They feel like they have had an experience when they're outdoors.
It's also particularly important, I imagine, given the climatic conditions that you have in Montgomery, to ensure that people have shade and, as you say, have an enjoyable walk and a walk that they're willing to do in the heat of the day.
Yes, exactly. So, and that's, again, where weather and climate comes into it. And so making people feel like they're not going to suffer when they go outside, they could have places that have shade or have seating or have a place to rest and then keep going. And, you know, we've got all kinds of little parts of Hampstead that are just little places for rest. So, you know, we have to have a playground within, you know, a few hundred feet of any house at a given time. Now, a playground can be many things. It could be a fenced playground with actual play equipment, or it could be a wild natural playground, you know, next to a farm, or it can be an area that's cleared out with a fire pit. You know, there's all different things that you can do that make life more interesting. And it doesn't have to be cost a lot of money. It doesn't have to be large and grandiose, but little thoughtful elements that make it interesting for kids and adults to explore the community.
Can we talk a little bit about vehicles, cars predominantly? How have you designed this development to make sure that vehicles, I guess, are a secondary element, acknowledging obviously that I'm imagining that most houses probably have at least one or two vehicles.
Yes. I mean, there's no getting around it. Every home has a car for sure. But what you notice is how much the cars stay parked. That sounds weird to say, but obviously our streets are narrower and slower, but we still do have on-street parking, you know, near or adjacent to all the homes. But if you notice it, you start to know what your neighbor's cars are. They don't use them as much as other neighborhoods do because they can get out and walk, or, you know, they can visit with their friends, or, and that's also the other thing is the sense of community and what happens, like people naturally interacting and realizing that, oh, this neighbor who is from another country that I would have never known somewhere else before, I have a lot in common with, and we become friends. And so that you can walk to each other's houses. Whereas, you know, in other neighborhoods where it's a little bit more isolated and people don't know each other because they don't have third places to interact, they never get to know each other. So they are constantly using their car to drive elsewhere, you know, to be with their friends.
And, and there's of course a safety aspect to that as well. You know, people that feel like they're part of a community feel safer. The safer you feel, the more you participate in the community, you know, whether that be walking or parks or whatever it might be.
Absolutely. Like you feel very comfortable knowing that, you know, I know, you know, 12 neighbors on my street and I'm friends with them and we all get along and our kids play together at the, you know, local restaurant or whatever. So there's that. And there's this that other sense of, you know, eyes on the street. Everyone's looking out for each other. You know, someone goes out of town, it's like, can I check your front porch to see if you get packages? I'll put them in my house. Or people have keys to like everybody else's house here. And it's just like, I'll stick your packages inside or I'll take care of your cat. It is actually extraordinary because for the first years of this project, I didn't even live here. I lived at my other project, right? And when I finally moved out here, when my sons were getting older and we wanted them to be outside and really have this lifestyle, I was blown away by how different it was from living where I previously had. And it's the sense of independence for children, which I think cannot be understated. You know, being able to be a parent and say, go outside, go out the door, play with your friends all day and be back at this time. And it's everyone does it, and it's safe, and it gives that sense of autonomy to children that they don't really have that often these days.
Yeah, it's probably sort of old school thinking, really, isn't it? I mean, sort of probably how we all grew up in a certain way.
Exactly.
But we don't do it very often now.
It's exactly how, I mean, we would leave the house at 7 a.m. in the summer and not come home till 8 at night. No one thought anything of it. And that happens here. And it's magical to see. The children here are, I don't know, they're free and they have friends all around them, and they know how to interact with adults because they're in and out of people's houses. It's really great.
Anna, Hampstead has a master plan. Can you talk about the importance of flexibility in that master plan? And I understand that early on, because of the 2008 recession, you were forced to pivot. And you've alluded to that flexibility you have. Can you talk about the importance of that?
Yes, and that's a great question. So the smart code that we have, you know, it allows for, we design our phases, and our master plan has this where there's all different lot sizes, correct? But we're not prescribed what type of house has to go there. So if, say, in 2008, we saw it was difficult to sell houses, right? So we realized a smaller homes would be easier because they're more affordable. So we can take a lot, say it's a, I'm getting very technical here, say it's a 36 foot wide lot. Well, if we want to build a smaller house on it, or if we want to build a set of townhouses, which have even smaller square footage, we can do that by right. We don't have to go back and say, oh, to the city, oh, this block was zoned for only attached product, but we really want to do single family homes that are small. We don't have to do anything like that. So based on any market demand or, you know, changes in, you know, economic situations, we can change our housing product to what suits us by right. And that is a huge amount of flexibility. Another pivot we've experienced in the past is, you know, when we first opened in 2008, we opened our town center first, which is very different from other new urbanist communities. You know, there's always a promise of a town center and renderings of a town center, but we knew that Montgomery was very unfamiliar with this product here in person. So we had to build probably the most interesting or unique aspect of it, which is a mixed use town center, in order to show people what we were saying. So we did that. Having said that, the buildings that we had were very large, and you know, it was a difficult time to lease to commercial tenants. It was difficult across the board. And so after, you know, a few years, those spaces were leased and filled up. We knew we needed more retail, but instead of building these expensive multi-story buildings, we pivoted and we did smaller detached buildings. I mean, like you would see now everywhere, but similar to when people transform a boxcar or train car into you know, a restaurant. We did smaller scale buildings that could actually be moved in the future to new sites. And then in that space, a permanent building could be built. And in doing that, we saw, you know, sometimes it's the less expensive, the more unique buildings that attract more people because they're not intimidated by beautiful architecture. They come out because that place is fun and serves, you know, food that costs less money. So being able to do these things by right and not asking for permission, has given us a huge opportunity to just respond to whatever we're dealt.
And is that level of trust, I guess, standard in these kinds of developments, or is that something that you really had to build?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure because, you know, in my mind, the best examples of these new urbanist communities nearby are along Florida's Gulf Coast, what we call 30A, which is the highway that runs and connects some places that your listeners may be familiar with. So Seaside, Florida, Rosemary Beach, Alice Beach, Watercolor, these places that our, you know, town planners planned and people that we know developed over time, you know, 20, 30 year projects, legacy projects. So I sense that some of those original founders of those communities had that level of trust with their municipality because they were living there and the people knew that they were there to do the right thing. And this was their lifetime project. I do think here there is a sense of trust over time because planning officials, city officials see what we produced. And, you know, if they ever did ask a question like, why would you want to do this? My response is, because we would never do anything that would hurt this community. This is what we do. This is the legacy we have. And so anything we want to do out here that you may think like, that's odd, why would you want to do it? It's to better this place. And again, like that sense of communication and trust and showing over time, I think just builds on itself.
And I think that word legacy that you're using is also incredibly important and probably something that we rarely really hear when we hear from developers. And I think that's a really important aspect of it. Anna, I really wanted to talk to you as well about learning and feedback and how you take the learnings from this community and use them for future parts of the development.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, if you're not learning from your mistakes, you're not paying attention. And, you know, I am the first one to put my hand and say, I make mistakes all the time. And it could be as small as like, you know, that detail on that house plan is not right, or we should have had a window there. But, you know, it's continuously looking back and redlining, and whether it's a house plan or a phase plan or even a master plan. You know, there were some things originally that we wanted to do, like put an island in the middle of a lake. And financially, it just didn't make sense. So, you know, being able to pause and say, you know, maybe this is a square peg in a round hole situation, and maybe we need to revisit this. And, you know, obviously taking feedback from home buyers or visitors and saying like, oh, you're missing this offering. You know, we're really looking for a house where my mother-in-law can live with us, or I'm really looking for this opportunity to be able to work from home, or looking at something like COVID and saying, I mean, we have outdoor environment here. So during COVID, this was amazing, but we could also, you know, take advantage of that and create more products where people could work from home. Because again, our zoning can't allow for that. And so, you know, just constantly listening to people and thinking, you know, not only what can we do that's unique that we haven't done, but what can we improve on? Because nothing's ever perfect, ever. And nothing's ever perfect the first time.
Anna, we'll put in our episode notes, we'll have links to Hampstead. But I'm curious, how do you create a new community and identity in a large project like Hampstead?
Very good question. Okay, so, you know, new urbanist communities, because many of them tend to be vacation communities, they tend to be second homes. Therefore, at least in our region, they tend to be more coastal, right? They can have a certain look. You know, everyone probably right now is picturing Seaside, Florida. They can have a look where it's siding and wood and front porches and pastel colors and things like that. We specifically did not want to do that. You know, we're in Montgomery. We're nowhere near water. We have great materials like brick made locally and great suppliers and great craftsmen and all these things that we knew we wanted to incorporate in our overall aesthetic, whether it's architecture, just the sense of how this place feels when you're driving or walking down the street. And so Andres Duany, who's our town planner with DPC, he always said, in a sense, we kind of just created our own aesthetic, and it's simple forms. You know, the homes, the buildings are boxes and rectangles. They're just detailed correctly as far as architectural details go. It's materials that are local and also stand the test of time. So there's an aesthetic there. So over time, as we were going through, you know, design house plans, this is before construction started, we had this sense of, you know, solidity, a sense of a very unique look. There's a lot of painted brick here, so it's light and bright. A sense that we were tying in historical architecture from older parts of Montgomery and even in Birmingham, which is an hour north here in Alabama, older details with some English influence, which Montgomery naturally has in its architecture and planning, but tying in, you know, details from Lutyens and Boise and all of these things into modern day floor plans. And it kind of just created its own aesthetic. And then touching on that, you know, the fact that we're not a vacation community, we are a full-time community of permanent, you know, homeowners who, let's be honest, Montgomery is a very rich U.S. city. So it has to be approachable from a financial standpoint, the homes do, and the lifestyle and all of it, but it still needs to feel like, in a sense, it's a vacation, you know, where you have all these great amenities, you have all these outdoor activities you can do, you know. So it kind of just created its own. And we came up with that phrase, Ham said, you know, life well lived. It's simple. It's straightforward. It is what it is. And so basically you can have a vacation every day, but just kind of creating that message that, you know, this is a special place here in Montgomery.
And Anna, have the new urbanist principles helped relax socioeconomic divides in Montgomery?
I would say yes, because we're able to offer something for all different ages and lifestyles, and offering all different price points, you're able to get in. You know, we have everyone here from college students to school teachers to people that work here in the restaurants. These people live in the community. We have a huge Korean population here in Montgomery because of Hyundai and businesses and suppliers. And I would say Hampstead is probably the most diverse in race, in age, and in interests of any community in Montgomery by far. And again, it's that interaction with neighbors that you may not have ever known or met before ever, and giving the opportunity for those interactions. And it's through those new urbanist principles of walkability and mixed use. There's no argument that somebody could make to me to the contrary on that.
And I imagine the housing mix that you mentioned before and the sort of homeowner and renter mix that you've devised also helps that process.
It absolutely does, because we might have somebody that rents here for 1 year. You might have that another person that rents for 5 years. You know, and a lot of it comes down to work and people coming in and out, or being stationed here at the military base at Maxwell, you know, but it gives you an opportunity to meet people from all over the world and at different points in their life and interact. And a lot of those people who rent, it's a tester, you know, they want to test what the lifestyle is and test how it feels to live in this part of town or in Hampstead itself. And then they just fall in love. And then they become the first time home buyer, and then they buy another house. You know, it's a way for people to have an entry point and try things out and then move up. And so I think that is a very important part of these new urbanist communities, or anywhere that has, you know, neighborhood scale apartments or ADUs where, you know, you could rent out a carriage house apartment. I think that's an important part to be able to bring in people that are, you know, new to the area or different ages, and let them become part of a community.
And is there also the ability to age in place in the community? Is there retirement and aged care facilities as well?
So we don't have a medical sort of situation in Hampstead, but I would say with the wellness opportunities that we have, you know, we've got the Hampstead Athletic Club, which is our local gym, and we have a studio that's focused on yoga and Pilates. And then we have, you know, tennis instructors, and we've got soccer groups out here. There's so many different opportunities for people of different, you know, abilities and ranges to get out and stay active. And for me, that's a lot of aging in place, is the ability to stay connected and, you know, mentally and physically stay sharp by, you know, having activity. And we tailor, well, the gyms tailor, you know, their programming to older people. And then of course, having a library where they can participate in a Montessori school where people volunteer. There's a lot of social interaction that I really think keeps people active and lets them stay in their community longer. And of course, neighbors that take care of them too, you know, checking on your neighbors and, you know, making food for them, inviting them over for Friendsgiving and things like that. I think that's like, it's the social aspect that can keep people able to age in place.
Absolutely. And we know for a fact that social isolation is really one of the biggest health diseases, really, of our population. So the more social connection we can have, the better that is for our communities.
Absolutely.
Anna, Wikipedia states that Montgomery has been recognised nationally for its downtown revitalisation and new urbanist projects. How does a city of 250,000 become one of the stars of the show?
That's a good question. I'm going to go back to one of the previous answers. So at the time when we did our charrette and the smart code was introduced and adopted, at that time, it was for projects that were a certain size and they were larger, right? It didn't apply to other areas of town. Well, what happened was as Hampstead developed, and this was key, the elected officials and some non-elected officials at that time were very progressive and interested in bringing new things to Montgomery because they knew the economic development that could come out of it and the press or the notoriety. So as Hampstead began developing and got traction and some of these others, they, and this is down from mayor to deputy mayor to head of planning, they were very interested in expanding this. So they brought in another firm to adapt the smart code as a mandatory code for all of downtown and also for some of the historic districts to help, in a sense, preserve what they had. And that was exceptional. That was a fantastic move. And I would say it had a huge impact in incentivizing people to develop or redevelop downtown and bring more life to it. I mean, commercial, residential, residential for sale and for lease, all kinds of development happened, I would argue, because of this code and that willingness to stand by the design guidelines of that.
And what places, Anna, apart from Hampstead, and I hope there's some studies done of how your community works, what other places can listeners look to for information on successful new urbanist projects? What are your favorites?
I would say that the Congress for the New Urbanism, which is CNU.org, is the central place to begin exploring and learning. They have a catalog of all different communities. They have great forums. They have meetups once a year, huge, all over the United States. They have chapters that get together. So CNU is a great organization. And essentially, it was founded by all of these amazing authors, planners, architects who have founded the movement over all of these decades. So that is definitely the place I would start. And then there's smaller things like Strong Towns is a good one. Resources all over, books. I mean, all of DPZ's books I would recommend as a place to get started. There's a lot out there, but CNU is definitely where I would begin.
I know we've spoken a lot about the positives and the positive lessons, I guess, that have come out of the New Urbanist Project. Were there any failures that you're willing to talk about or anything, I guess, that you look back on and think, oh, we should have done that differently?
Sure, absolutely. There were tons of building plans that we had designed, like full construction sets. And whether it's because of the Great Recession of 2008 and the years after that, they just got shelved. And that was actually a blessing in disguise, I'll be honest, because some of those buildings were just far too expensive. And, there wasn't a need. It was almost as if we felt like we needed to have things like that, like a grand gathering hall that was two stories and all glass and all these things, just because maybe we'd seen something like that before or experienced it in a neighborhood in Florida along 30A. Well, those are very different price points. And, so I think the lesson there is, you don't have to go over the top. Sometimes being good enough is good enough. And over time, bigger and larger scale projects can be added and slotted in. But for now, focusing on what the core of it, of what we do, is just building excellent quality houses where people can live an excellent life. And, I think that there are things we even implemented that we didn't have to do, that we could have saved money on and done differently. Maybe we didn't need a bocce pavilion. Maybe we could have put in a pickleball court earlier. Just little things that you think, would have done that different. So again, learning from your mistakes is probably the most important way to learn.
It sounds, Anna, that you've got an inbuilt flexibility in your plan so that you can adjust when things change.
Yes, and being able to recognize when you need to adjust is important too.
That's right.
I think Pete, though, that's one of the issues that probably a lot of modern developments are missing. There's just a lack of flexibility, particularly in some of our more recent experiences and discussions with some of our guests, is that flexibility would change everything. It's really integral, I think, to a successful development outcome.
Maybe, Anna, it takes two to dance. I mean, the regulators have to not insist on, designing something for 10 years and no flexibility. And also the people who put these things together, the developers have to have a passion, and maybe that comes with a building company of your size and your interests rather than a big corporation. Am I being a bit unfair, do you think?
No, I think you're being 100% correct. So another example, I would say, back in Seaside in Florida, the developer Robert Davis, it was his family's land. You know, he had memories of going there in his childhood. It was his legacy, and he solely wanted the best outcome for this. Granted, it's made a lot of money and it's been incredibly successful, but he still lives there. He still knows everyone there, and he's put his entire life into that project. And I think it's having, obviously the flexibility we talked about, but having a commitment to wanting solely the best for this place and this project, and having that vision that you stick with. So it's a combination of being, in a sense, flexible and inflexible at the same time.
I think it's also an amazing sign when the developer or one of the developers lives in the development. A very, very good sign.
Yes, because you're like, this is excellent. This is where I want to be. And hopefully that convinces others to want to be here.
And I think, Anna and Jess, also one part of development we don't really acknowledge is the emotion and the pride of people being associated with good outcomes. I mean, I'm sure the city officials must take a lot of pride and joy in Hampstead, and likewise the other places you mentioned. And also, you mentioned you wouldn't do something that would hurt your project. You wouldn't cut corners. So do you think we need to recognize emotion and celebrate that part of the whole mix?
Yes, I think we need to recognize commitment and emotion and passion, and then be able to recognize, just by watching people, by watching strangers. Sometimes I just sit here and stare at people and seeing how happy this place makes them, or just watching kids run around and have fun, and or watching a huge amount of people, hundreds and hundreds of people, come out for Thursday night kids soccer games, and just watching all these people enjoy their life here and thinking, this is good. This feels good.
Well, Jess, I don't know about you, but I'm keen to go and live in Hampstead now.
Come join
absolutely.
Me.
I'm definitely going to visit when I finally make it over.
Please do.
The South is great, Jess. Best part of the States, I think. Now, Anna, we've come to Podcast Extra, Culture Corner, which we ask our guests something you've read, seen, watched, listened to, experienced lately that might be of interest to our listeners.
Okay, this is fun. So I noticed that you both like to cook. I really do too. It's just my passion. Of course, eating, that's too. So what I was obsessed with recently, I don't know if it's in Australia. I mean, you can stream it, I'm sure. But if you've heard of the series called The Bear, which is set in Chicago, and it's all about this family restaurant and this world-class chef who's one of the sons comes back and tries to save it and then bring new life into it and do something totally different with it. That is an excellent show. There's two series and it is mind-blowing. The music's also great. So I think you would enjoy that. And the other thing that we've been doing recently is creating sourdough bread. And it's very frustrating and rewarding at the same time. So that's been fun. And then the last thing I would say that's been amazing was I went skiing for the first time in 20 years to Colorado, to Beaver Creek with my family. And it was one of the best experiences of my life. So if you ever come to the United States and have that opportunity, you should do that too.
Yeah. And I've recently had a cookbook, bought a cookbook. It's called Oats from the North, Wheat from the South. And it's all regional British baking recipes. And I know that there's a strong English, Scottish, they were part of the development of Alabama and other southern states. And that's a terrific book because it looks at historic recipes, and the oats from the north is because that's what they grew up there, and wheat in the south. So they all have very different regional baking styles. But that might be of interest to you. Jess, what about your podcast extra?
Well, Anna, I gave up on my sourdough baking long ago.
I understand.
I think I killed my starter probably a year and a half ago, and I haven't actually gone back to it. But I've actually I've gone away from sourdough, and I now make it was a New York Times recipe, no knead bread, which is I'd say almost equally as good as sourdough. It's not sourdough, but it sort of looks and tastes like sourdough, and it's amazing. So you can Google that recipe, and it's just
Jess, I've made it. It's so good.
Oh, amazing. And I've also got another one, which is a focaccia style, which is also a no knead, which is also incredible. And that leads on to my recommendation, which is an Instagram person by the name of Sarah, Wholesome by Sarah, who does some amazing recipes. And that's actually where the focaccia recipe comes from. It's incredible. You put olives and tomatoes and sea salt all over the top. It's just amazing. I've been making it weekly at the moment. And she's just about to release her first cookbook, which I would highly recommend. I've got that on pre-order at the moment. And my other recommendation, Pete, is Nemesis, which is a political documentary, I guess you'd call it, about our three former prime ministers in Australia, available on ABC iView. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have probably already watched it, but found that really, really interesting. What about you, Pete?
I love history, Anna, and I particularly like local history. And I've just finished a book, The Enigma of Snake Island. It's about a part of the coast near where I grew up in Geelong. And this fellow, Robert Ganley, has written an extraordinary detailed book about a fairly unattractive area, but he's made it incredibly interesting to me. And I just think, you know, when we look at creating new communities and creating identity, it's always good to look back in the past. And there's so many useful references. Some, you know, some might be uncomfortable, but others typically are very enjoyable. So do you like local history, Anna?
I do. And obviously being from Montgomery, there's a lot of it. But I was a history, it was my favorite subject. And I love American history and European history. Those are my two tops. But my dad is a huge history buff, and he probably reads four books at a time all the time. So, yes.
Anna, thank you so much for, sadly we're coming to an end now, but thank you so much for your time. And it just sounds a wonderful creation, Hampstead, and the other projects you've done. And we'll have all references on our episode notes. And thanks so much for your time. It's been great fun.
Thank you, guys. This was so much fun. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Anna. Ditto. Absolutely loved it.
All right. You guys take care.
Thanks for listening. If you would like to hear more of our podcasts, hit the follow button on Spotify or the like button on SoundCloud or the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts. Please also visit our Instagram page, LinkedIn, or website for behind-the-scenes footage of our podcasts and to get the latest on upcoming or recently released episodes. If you have any suggestions or feedback, please get in touch via our social media channels or by emailing planningexchange@gmail.com. A special shout out also to Jack Babbage, who does such an incredible job in producing this podcast.